Morning. Seems to be a common theme of this symposium, but hey, I'm also not an entomologist. I'm a vertebrate biologist, but I'd like to thank Chris and Dazeen for inviting me here and other people for getting me involved in this research, because it's been a really good conference so far and really interesting area to engage in. And what I want to talk to about today is an analysis we're doing that's kind of encompassed in this TRIA project, which Chris introduced, which is to look at the mountain pine beetle outbreak, but to look at it in kind of a multifaceted sense, in the sense we're looking at the beetle, the fungus, as Colette talked about, and the trees themselves, which are no one's really talked about, but the ORGS group is involved in. What I'm going to talk about today is not genomic sense, it's maybe population genetics, and really our analysis of the microsatellite variation of the Western Canadian mountain pine beetle epidemic. Change this. Now this is an outbreak map, cumulative outbreak map from 1999 to 2007, that's showing the extent of the mountain pine beetle outbreak within British Columbia, and it's quite massive. It's encompassing about 10.1 million hectares as of 2007, and put it in another sense, that's about 710 million cubic meters of lodgepole pine forests. I think Fraser McKee, I heard it in another talk today, to put this in reference, is about the size of the state of Ohio. Okay. Now the objectives of this particular phase of the TRIA project are really to determine the population structure of the mountain pine beetles in Western Canada, and then to use that data to study dispersal patterns, whether they be historic or the current dispersal patterns, and I'm going to talk about those today. And then also really to develop a neutral data set with which to contextualize studies of adaptive variation. And Amanda Rowe will probably be kind of introducing that in this whole concept of developing an integrative genomic landscape map for the outbreak itself. But that will perhaps come later. Okay. So just in terms of meth development, we have the microsatellites for the mountain pine beetles were being developed independently in two different labs. If part of the TRIA project was being developed at the University of Alberta, but also previous to that was being developed by Karen Mock's lab in Utah State University. And both of these labs independently started to develop microsatellite libraries. And to the best of their ability, they surface sterilized the beetle, took muscle tissues out, developed genomic libraries from that, went to find some primer sets. And one of the interesting things is that both labs at the University of Alberta and at Utah State University found a significant proportion of the microsatellite clones and microsatellites that they were pulling out were amplifying up fungal DNA. So you can see in the University of Alberta we had 1,500 clones, 120 primer sites, and a significant portion of those would amplify up fungal DNA. We haven't really fully followed it up to see if they're amplifying, if those sequences were of fungal origin, but there would be problems with those in any case. So from those 120, we have optimized 11 primer sets at the University of Alberta, and Utah State had optimized 5 primer sets. And this is going to be published pretty shortly. We're developing a primer note, which is going to go into by molecular ecology resources, in which you're taking those 16 loci, looking at the variation of Alberta beetles, and even looking at progeny trials, looking at their segregation. Now, in terms of the entire project, this is representing our sample of mountain pine beetles. And what you can see from this map, it's obviously a map of Western Canada. You're seeing a number of components. First of all, you're seeing the lodgepole pine, the primary host of the mountain pine beetle, shown in yellow. We're also showing the jack pine distribution. You're seeing these two hybridization zones in Alberta and Northwest Territories. The mountain pine beetle is primarily restricted, shown by this kind of crotch-hatched area within British Columbia. And in here, there's two sample types. We have these circles that are shown kind of on the BC-Alberta border, running up through the Rocky Mountains, which are part of the TRIO project, which involves sampling of the trees, the beetles, and the fungus in a lot of detail. Now, I'm not going to be talking about those today. What I want to talk about today is a data set that Stafford and I, Lindgren and I, started to develop kind of before the project, which are these boxes shown throughout British Columbia. And those are samples in which we only sampled mountain pine beetles. Okay. So the primary thing I want to talk about then is just the initial survey of this microsatellite variation at those particular sample sites, and kind of what we can infer then about the beetles and their dispersal patterns. Okay. This is work that primarily done by a master's student, Nicholas Bartel, and again with the aid of microsatellite development at the University of Alberta and Utah State University. Okay. So here's showing those same sample locations again, this time with a topographical map, which I'm going to be showing a number of times. There's 35 sites, primarily collected in 2005 and 2006. There's one site here, Grand Prairie, which was collected in 2007. Okay. We're looking at an average of about 46 beetles per sample location, which is about 1,600 beetles. And in each of those sample locations, the beetles were collected from independent galleries. So we're taking about 4 galleries per tree over a sample location, making sure that we're not kind of sampling siblings. In any case, we're almost biasing against sampling siblings. And we're only using a fraction or a subset of those 16 microsatellites, because this work was actually going on at the same time. So these are some of the original ones that were developed, but these are also very polymorphic markers. So we have 4 from the University of Alberta collection and 2 from the Utah State collection. Okay, analysis of data. The first thing we wanted to do was simply compare our sample sites, and we did this by doing an AMOVA, which is analysis of molecular variants, the program Arlequin. And what we find, and we'll get to this map in a second, is that about 80% of our pairwise comparisons are significantly different. Now this, and overall we have an FST value of about 0.038, which is a fairly small FST value for an entire population. Again, 80% are significantly different. Now this is a bit, this is an uncorrected data set. We have multiple comparisons there, so strictly we should apply a Bonferroni correction, and when we do that, the number of significant comparisons drops down to about 60. But because we have so many pairwise comparisons, we're kind of feeling we're being really overly conservative there. The real estimate is probably somewhere in between that 80 and 60. This map, though, however, is based on this 80%, the uncorrected data set, and what we're showing here are the non-significant comparisons. We haven't included the corrected data set here because we really want to make sure that we're not going to put any type 2 errors here, in which we have not rejected a hypothesis of genetic sample sites that are really genetically dissimilar or genetically different, but we couldn't reject that hypothesis. So this is kind of conservative data set. You can think of it in that way. And what we see here is primarily a gradient of relationships that we see a lot of connections in the north, a lot in the south, and this kind of gradient throughout the province. This is supported by a neighbor joining tree of the populations based on Nate's genetic distance, standard genetic distance. Now this is a very weakly supported tree, as you can see. There's very few bootstrap. The bootstrap support is very low, but it does show the trend in what we're seeing in the data, and that we have the northern populations are in this part of the tree, the southern populations are in this part of the tree, and we're seeing again this gradient of relationships. We do see 5 populations that were genetically distinct before correction. These include McBride, shown here, Mackenzie and Tumbler Ridge. This is Mackenzie shown here, Tumbler Ridge shown here, Wilmore Wilderness, and Whistler. And each of these populations in this tree are kind of indicated by relatively long branch length. So she is showing us some sort of information that is in the data and how it allows you to contextualize those unique populations. When we look at the corrected data set, only the McKenzie population, this one right in the middle, remains unique or significantly different from all other populations. So we also wanted to look at population structure then amongst all of these 35 locations. And to do that, we used a number of Bayesian approaches. We started off with the population, the computer program structure, and then moved on to TESS because TESS works a little better, or supposedly works a little better, for smaller FST values. The other major difference between these two is that TESS utilizes population information, geographic information, while structure does not. But both of them essentially are trying to look at individual genotypes and group them into a defined number of K populations. So we assessed K in this particular one from 2 to 35. It became pretty clear as we got above 4 that our population structure was falling apart. There's no longer any geographic kind of pattern that we saw to our populations, kind of just randomized. For K to 2 to 4, we did multiple runs, and what we think is that our best kind of structure is shown at K equals 2, or two populations, two groups for this data set. We verified that with 20 runs, and they all came out to show exactly the same data. The only thing that differed was our likelihood values. Again, so then we find a northern and a southern population, and if I can get this pointer, what's shown here is kind of the boundary between them of a 50-50 probability line. The ones north of this line have a greater than 50% chance of belonging to the northern group, and south of that to the southern group. We've also included these 70-30 lines just for comparison, because we get those values with our analysis. If we take this north-south data and we put it into AMOVA at k equals 2, we get a significant FST value, so showing there is some sort of significant structure going on. We also tried another approach, and this is another Bayesian approach, but this time it uses population information, not individual genotype information. This is called SAMOVA. It also uses geographic information to try to put, again, the populations into a number of groups. And here we assessed K2 to 15. And when we got above 2, we go to 3 or 4 or 5. We no longer get any groups, but we get two major groups, say for 3, and then a single sample location branching off as another population. We go to 4, it's the same thing. We get these two groups and then two other populations with singletons. And that kind of indicates that kind of reached a significant value of K. The distribution between these, again, is north and south, and that's shown with this black line, which is closer to the 70-30 line found by the individual Bayesian analyses. Again, our ANOVA or AMOVA is significant. And just for the remainder of the talk, when I'm talking about northern and southern populations, I'm going to use this SAMOVA as our kind of dividing between these two groups, because we're finding some kind of interesting trends with that data set. And the first of all is a kind of our analysis of isolation by distance. Now, isolation by distance, I don't know if you can see those. The labels are not readable. But what you're doing by an isolation by distance is you're looking at each of those sample locations and you're looking at a measure of genetic similarity or genetic distance between your sample locations. In this case, it's FST. And then comparing that to geographic distance. And in the southern populations, what we see is a nice correlation between genetic or geographic distance shown here and genetic distance shown on this scale. In the northern populations or northern sites, however, there's no evidence for isolation by distance. Okay. So just to summarize what I've talked about so far, in terms of population structure, we have about 60 to 80% of our sample locations are showing, are genetically distinct from each other, but it's a complicated pattern. We see this north-south gradient of genetic relationships. And for the southern group, we have this good evidence of isolation by distance, which is pretty interesting, because isolation by distance is a pattern that takes many, many generations to build up. And it's basically coming about because you're getting more migration in the short term, kind of stepwise migration, as opposed to migration or gene flow that's more randomized amongst those sample sites, and that you're getting just as much long-term or long-distance gene flow as short gene flow. Isolation by distance indicates there's more short-term gene flow going on, and it takes a long term for that to build up. So what that's really indicating for the southern group is that there's more long-term stability of the beetle populations in the southern part of the province, and also that there's this prominence of short versus long-term dispersal for the beetles in that part of the province. And that kind of makes sense when you look at the topography of southern BC. There's a lot of mountain ranges. There's a lot of barriers to dispersal in that part of the province. What we think that's really neat is that when we look at that distribution, this is the Samova line again, and compare that to climatic suitability models. This is climatic suitability done by Alan Carroll, 2006, and what he's shown, what he did here is he looked at the 30-year means, average means of suitable temperatures for a mountain pine beetle. He ranges those from, say, very low to extremely high. Again, southern BC has always been more suitable in temperature for the mountain pine beetle, and we see this nice correlation in this historic pattern, say 1921 to 1950, with our actual north-south divide that's shown by the Samova analysis. Starts to break down a little bit in the more recent ones, 1971, 2000, and it's only become more extreme north. But this, the correlation of these stable populations with climatic suitability is also kind of interesting. Now in the northern group, we don't see any evidence for this isolation by distance. We also see a larger number of these unique populations. I wouldn't do stats on this, but we see 3 versus 10 versus 2 versus 25 for the southern group. And there could be a number of reasons that we think that could have led to this kind of genetic pattern. First of all, the climatically less suitable regions may have led to populations that are temporally less stable. They have perhaps lower endemic population numbers and a higher chance of local extinction than the southern groups. Another thing that could relate here is that the populations of the north could just be younger and reflect kind of the leading edge of this post-ice age range expansion of the mountain pine beetles north into these more suitable regions. And finally, that gene flow is perhaps more random. You're getting more long distance dispersal in the north. Now our evidence can't really reject any of these hypotheses, but the fact that we get more unique populations in the north argues against a little bit against this gene flow being a little bit more random in the north. Perhaps we're getting more of this kind of a metapopulation analysis within the northern populations. What's also interesting is that when we look at gradients of genetic diversity, on the top we see mean heterozygosity with, in the bottom, distance from the US border. We see this decreasing trend of heterozygosity, observed heterozygosity in the northern populations, and that's also mirrored by the number of alleles that we see in the northern populations. Now this kind of data really starts to point to this second hypothesis, because it is what you expect for expanding populations. It's been seen in a large number of other studies, phylogeographic studies, that have shown for expanding populations that are not maybe creeping forward but jumping into new locations, having founder effects, you do see this reduced amount of genetic variation on the leading edge. Okay. So that's kind of what we feel is going on historically with the mountain pine beetles. We also wanted to see what was going on currently. And to think about the current, what I've done is taken some data off the Canadian Forest website that's showing kind of cumulative outbreak maps from 1999 to 2004, where the data stops. I'll just show a couple of these. And I'm doing this in particular because I want to address a particular hypothesis, which is the Tweedsmuir hypothesis. Tweedsmuir is a provincial park in British Columbia, shown right there, which some people have believed is the epicenter of the entire current epidemic in British Columbia. So this is showing this outbreak in 1999. What I also wanted to point out, though, is other populations, especially in the south, are also showing this, also showing outbreaks at the same time. So you can see it building up. And I'll try to do this quickly. This can lead to this is why some people have this Tweed's mirror hypothesis, because you can clearly see it's building up over time. But what that also predicts is really a genetic homogenization of sample locations throughout the province. And we think this is especially true with mountain pine beetles, because the number of beetles that are involved in the epidemic are so large that we really don't expect founder effects to occur. We think if genetic bottlenecks are occurring, they're occurring in the endemic phase when the numbers are crashing. So the genetic evidence clearly supports a multi-epicenter analysis, and this supports the spatial temporal analysis of that data set by Akuma et al. In 2006, which obviously found evidence for a Tweed's mirror epicenter, but also found good evidence for multiple epicenters occurring at the same time in the southern populations. Okay. We also looked at expanding populations in the northeast part of the province. These are populations that are across the Rocky Mountain Divide in areas where we really didn't see too many mountain pine beetles before. They incurred the Pine Pass, which is just in the Rockies, Tumbler Ridge again, Grand Prairie, and the Wilmore Wilderness. Now the Grand Prairie is a really interesting event in that this is in Alberta, and this population, they know, arose in 2006 through this massive dispersal event. They call it kind of a beetle rain. So we sampled these beetles after this massive dispersal event, and our evidence shows that these basically are genetically indistinguishable from the beetles in the northwest portion of British Columbia. Okay. See the same thing for the Pine Pass. The Tumbler Ridge population is kind of interesting. Based on observational ones, there was no beetles there prior to about 2002. And it's kind of one of our weakly supported unique populations, in that when we correct for multiple comparisons, it becomes part of this group, just like Grand Prairie and Tumbler Ridge. The last thing I wanted to talk about was just kind of this, the last population, which is the Wilmore population, which had a higher, again, mean FST than we would expect. And there was also observational data that suggested that the beetles were there from at least 1997, so pre this current outbreak. So there could be two options. This population was founded in the past century. We're seeing differences there, or that it was founded during a previous outbreak in the 1980s and has now suffered a genetic bottleneck since then. Okay. In fact, it's related, most closely related to the populations that would have represented the northeastern extent of that current one. Okay. I'll just go through that and just to highlight. And the last thing I want to highlight is just the kind of research that we still have to do with this. And the next thing we want to do is kind of confirm the patterns we're seeing with that full set of 16 loci, get detailed analysis of the expanding Alberta populations, which are really interesting because those are going to include these other ones where we've sampled both the mountain pine beetle, the pine, and the fungus. And these ones also include a temporal aspect, because we have samples from 2005, 2006. These samples are from 2007, 2008, all from similar locations. So now we can start to look at temporal variation, how it's changing over time. So this is going to become really kind of exciting research that should be coming up. And then we have two other projects that are going on. The other one is just to look at the genomic data that's being developed by Chris Keeling and others, and to look at microsatellites that are found that are linked to genes. And those could be used in a number of studies, such as just doing linkage maps or maybe some population genomic studies. And then we also want to look at host switching that's going on within the current outbreak. Thanks. Sorry.
Maybe just one quick question.
Yeah.
Idea of multiple epicenters, I think, of mitochondrial data, and this would also give you an idea of historic
DNA?
Yeah, we didn't personally look at mitochondrial DNA. I know that Amanda, I was talking to Amanda last night, and you started to look at, the University of Alberta started to look at some of the mitochondrial DNA variation for these populations. It'd be kind of interesting because with the mitochondrial DNA variation, we could start to link it into some of the studies that have been done within the United States at those markers and kind of develop a larger picture of what's going on. I'm not sure that we'd see the same amount of resolution that we see with the microsatellites, though.
But you might see it as split.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what you're saying is that integration of those big sources.
I don't know if it's an integration or a movement. But yeah. You test that hypothesis. Yeah.
Great. Let me thank Brent Murray again.
Okay, thank you.